You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Zainab is one of our newest fellows as part of our incoming class this year. She is newly at the University of North Carolina as an assistant professor at School of Information and Library Science and in the Department of Sociology. And she is here to talk to us about social media and the dynamics of collective action under authoritarian regimes. She has written extensively on this and is definitely an expert in the area. So welcome, Zainab.
Thank you. So I'm going to be talking about some of the conceptual issues related to collective action and social media under authoritarian regimes in particular. I'm going to then present some data that was collected in Tahrir during the unrest in the month of February and some of the preliminary analyses that we've done on it. I want to end by talking a little bit about the problems of transition and democracy and what this means or does not mean for more open societies, because I think one of the key differences they will encounter is that things work really differently depending on the structure of society. So let me start by defining a concept, durable authoritarianism. You might have heard of this if you read political science literature. See, the thing is, if you were just looking at the writings on topic of Egypt or Libya or, you know, Tunisia, you would encounter something like these regimes really seem to have cracked the code for staying in power for decade after decade. They were seen as somehow managing to contain their societies. And I think the real question there is, how did they manage this and how did they not fall for so long is a more valid question than, well, why did they fall? Because if you go and talk to people, look at the first batch of polls we have coming out of Egypt especially, it's clear the regime was deeply unpopular. So the question of how a deeply unpopular regime maintains power for so long, you know, not just a few years, but 20, 30, 40 years in the case of Gaddafi, is, I think, really worth exploring and understanding. And also how social media and the connectivity infrastructure plays into how they fell. So in one sense, what I'm saying is that the descent was rather invariant. Of course, we don't really have representative scientific surveys. I would wager that Mubarak was also just as unpopular 10 years ago. So I'm not saying that there was a sharp increase in descent this year or last year. I think there might have been some with the global food crisis. All of those probably were factors. But I would have wagered that any kind of semi-open election would have resulted in the ouster of these regimes, all of them that are now under threat. So how did they stay in power? The main answer, of course, this is not the only way, but the main answer is to create a collective action problem for their populations. A collective action problem is a problem where you have a situation which could be resolved by mass participation, but where there are high costs for individuals, high costs for failure, and it's hard to communicate, organize. Now, there are many versions of this. You can look at it as a sort of a public goods problem where there's some benefit, but you can't really exclude people from benefiting, so you have then the free rider kind of issues. Why would anybody participate? Those are related but not the same. Here we're talking about a situation in which there really is a strong need. There really is a strong need, back channels there. I'm torn between turning it off and occasionally glancing at the back channel. Where there are high costs and real incentives, but to be first is, or to be at the forefront of this action is of a lot of consequence, negative consequence. If you think about, for example, the tragic situation about a few months ago in Norway, where one lone gunman managed to kill, I think, 80 kids in the end. It was just a horrific number. And even though he had a gun, you do think, you know, 80 people at once with a single gun, how does this occur? Well, this is an example of a, you know, tragic collective action problem, is that it's very hard for teenagers right there, just to sort of in the middle of the chaos, to do anything coordinated at, you know, at the risk of maybe 20, 30 of them being killed and then sort of taking out this person, because he was, in the end, one person with one rifle. It wasn't even, say, a machine gun or something. He couldn't have killed 80 people at once. So this is kind of an example of a collective action problem. There's high calls for individuals, and it's hard to communicate, organize. Now, I'm not saying the collective action problem is the only dynamic. There's patronage systems, ethnic divisions, nationalism, economic success. In the case of other durable authoritarian regimes like China, So those are all part of it. But I've been studying sort of social media and internet. That's what I've studied pretty much my whole career. That's why I'm talking about that. And I want to say that also to emphasize that there's been this sort of backlash, especially from Egyptian academics and sometimes activists on the region. Why are you all discussing the internet and social media? And I tell them, this is all I've done ever. I mean, it's not like I've changed my mind for you. This is what I do actually study. It doesn't mean that the other factors are of no consequence. It's just I'm focusing on one dynamic and how it plays across. So I want to highlight that, because they are kind of, they're like, stop asking us about this. Ask us about labor unions or something else. Well, and they have a point. Other people should ask more of that, but this is what I do study at the moment. So, how do you do a collective action problem? Now, this is one thing you do, and these are kind of obvious if you look at it, but they are remarkably missing from social movement literature that we have in academia, partly because the social movement literature we have is mostly based on studying Western movements, where these are not the problems, right? So repression and how it works is really under-theorized. And then you, of course, don't really get the key role that information connectivity plays. So one of the things you do is you create structures of censorship. And we'll talk about this. Make it easier to isolate and crush. You restrict means of organization so people can't come together. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. You create a high cost for individual dissent, right? Basically, what you do, there's a lot of torture, and that kind of sort of severe punishment by all these regimes, and it is not some side effect. It is not some sort of, oh, there's just a lot of sadistic police or a sadistic, you know, regime. I think it is an integral part and parcel of how these regimes operate, is to create a high cost for individual dissent. And then minimize the potential protest cascades. And I will talk about this in just a second, too. But I want to highlight one thing. The way this works is not just necessarily through restricting information, because what you want to do, if you're sort of an authoritarian regime, is to look at dissent as kind of like a disease and conceptualize it. I mean, they might even, like, if they were sort of reading the academic literature, I think they would find it more familiar to read epidemiology and how epidemiologists view diseases. Because what you want to do is to try to quarantine the disease descent at the earliest stage. You want to isolate it from other pockets if you can. You want to find and isolate the hubs that might carry it from one place to another. And you really find this kind of behavior in authoritarian regimes. So, and you'll see that it's not all censorship without thought, because cases of torture are often not really, not the word isn't publicized, but it's made sure that the people who were involved in whatever the act was know that the dissident was tortured. We're seeing lots of examples of this in Syria now. There's a famous case of, like, the singer whose song became kind of like the anthem of the movement. They apparently sent back, reportedly sent back his dead body, obviously. I mean, he, with the larynx torn out as a message, right? So they're not hiding all repression. They're publicizing in some way, saying this is what we do to you, and I don't think that's coincidental. Meanwhile, they're also, what they are doing is hiding information about dissent breaking out somewhere, because you want, you know, you want to censor that because of the cascade, the potential for cascade. Because there's two things that need to be taken into account. Because of lack of institutional checks on repression, there's always this notion that these regimes could do anything they want. They could endlessly suppress and endlessly repress, and that's not the case. For one thing, they're states. They're resource-constrained actors. I mean, just because there's no, like, say, a Supreme Court or an independent judiciary checking on them doesn't mean they have limitless options. They are resource-constrained, so they could not, in effect, crush everything, every mass uprising that they encounter, because they would have a problem just of resources. And legitimacy always plays a role. Even in the most authoritarian regime, there has to be a certain level of buy-in by some people to carry this out. So they don't have, it's a balancing game, that they have to be fairly agile in how they repress. And if they lose that agility, they can often. So now I'm going to explain the let's hope that this can play. Everything I just said, if you've seen this, you will know. This is a scene from It's a Bug's Life. The grasshoppers are surviving by stealing the ants, the food that ants produce. And what's going to, they found this new place, and they're like, let's stay here, and, you know, it's got all this great stuff. So they're celebrating and discussing their options. So the grasshoppers are our oppressors.
Guys, order another round, because we're staying here. Yeah. Yeah. What was I thinking going back to Ant Island? I mean, we just got here, and we have more than enough food to get us through the winter, right? Why go back? But there was that ant that stood up to me.
Yeah, but we can forget about him.
Yeah, it was just one ant.
Yeah, you're right. It's just one ant.
Yeah, boss, they're puny.
Puny? Say, let's pretend this green is a puny little ant.
Did that hurt?
Nope.
Well, how about this one?
Are you kidding?
How about this?
You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
He's quite the motivational speaker, isn't he?
Let's ride!
So, I will turn off the back channel, so I'm convinced. Okay, because I always want to check what people are saying. Questions. So basically, that's the theory of repression of sorts in a grasshopper kind of way. All that I've been saying. So to go back to the less fun and less artistic versions of this, what you end up happening is two mechanisms that's been studied a lot in sort of authoritarian regimes by political scientists. One is preference falsification, and the other is pluralistic ignorance. Preference falsification is when people hold a view but do not reveal it, and because either social norms or fear of repression, and that ends up resulting in a situation we call pluralistic ignorance, where everybody privately believes something but thinks that everybody else publicly believes something else, because everybody's falsifying their preference. So basically what you have is a situation of emperor has no clothes, where everybody's really unhappy with something, but nobody's really publicly expressing this. And then you create a pluralistic ignorance where everybody thinks everybody else is. So, for example, if you all thought, you know, where is this talk going? She's just meandering. I want to get out of here. But nobody's really getting up and going. And everybody's, like, appearing very intense and pretending to listen. And if one person got up, maybe it would start a cascade. Maybe I shouldn't be giving this example. But that would be a pluralistic ignorance. And, in fact, sometimes you see this in conferences where the back channel breaks that, where some talk is not going well or people are objecting to it, and you know, we're usually used to let's talk to our audiences, and then you've had situations, not always pleasant, right? It's a complicated thing how to manage something like this. So pluralistic ignorance can be broken by means. Now, I was talking the other day, I met with in my new school Charles Kurzman, who studied intensively the Iranian Revolution, and he was explaining the situation to me about how everybody, right before the sort of the revolutionary period or during the revolutionary period, everybody was just constantly trying to talk to each other and say, what do you think, what do you think, what do you think? You know, everybody was just, he was describing the situation of everyone talking to their cab drivers and their hairdressers and the grocer and whoever else they could get their hands off, because there was this intense desire to get out of the pluralistic ignorance of maybe decades. Now, in Egypt and in Tunisia. And I've been told again and again and again that that people rarely talk politics outside of fairly trusted circles except online. And we'll talk about the except online part. So it was a situation where through self-censorship, real censorship, coercion, repression, a developed social norm, you really had the perfect ground for pluralistic ignorance where it's not that people didn't know that Mubarak was unpopular. They probably had a good sense that most of the country didn't like him. But how badly? How badly? What were people willing to do in that situation? Because you have this perception shapes reality. If people think, well, this guy's not very popular, but who's going to stick their neck out to get rid of him? Then you have a different kind of dynamic. You can have spirals of silence versus spirals of action under these situations. So enter the new media ecology. And I keep talking about the new media ecology because what happened can really not be, I mean, the role of connectivity infrastructure, I think you can't really get to it without looking at Al Jazeera and to a degree other satellite channels, but Al Jazeera is key. Picture video enabled mobile devices, which are near saturation levels in Cairo. I mean, in Egypt, too, you have, I think, 80-90% penetration of cell phones right now, which basically means in Cairo you have fairly everyone who's either not very old or, I mean, children. And I often get the sort of response saying, well, the poor people don't have it. And I want to say, no. It's actually the opposite, because if you're poor, you really need these more. I've seen this in a lot of poor countries, including my own home country, Turkey, because if you've been to Cairo or Istanbul, you know you can't plan anything. I mean, the traffic, the whatever might be happening. And if you're an informal street merchant or if you're anybody who doesn't have a very stable office, no pressure job, the cell phone is your lifeline. I mean, it's the first thing you buy. And very often there are all sorts of payment methods. And people usually text because it's cheaper. So it's really just not the case that poor people in third world countries don't have cell phones. Yes, of course. I mean, beyond a certain level of poverty, you're really talking about sub-Saharan Africa. You will have, you know, sort of income coming up. But what you're seeing in countries like Turkey, countries like Egypt, which are beyond a certain level of income, in big cities, the sort of the informal sector, the poor, they make an extra effort to make sure they have a functioning cell phone because it's also an economic device. It's where you learn, you know, oops, the cops are coming to clear out that street from merchants, and you really want to know that before it's happening. Your livelihood is at stake, and planning anything is very hard. So and modern devices, most of them, they come with the picture capacity fairly almost as a default. My I'm surviving. I'm just like buying these old versions of the same cell phone I've had forever because I have many chargers for it. I keep losing the cell phone and I have many chargers for it. And it has all these capacities, even though it's very, very old model, and it's still, you know, just you can buy it on eBay for a dollar now. Basically, somebody will give it to you for almost no money. So the mobile devices are very important to this media ecology, and also social media. And by social media, we'll unpack that a little bit. But I want to emphasize Ethan Zuckerman's cute cat theory, which you haven't heard of it. It's like the theory he's famous for that he's never managed to write the full paper for. We keep teasing him about it. But it's really an important insight into why these things work, because there have been, the way they do, there have been attempts at political organizing in the Middle East at the latest from the beginning of 2000s. And I actually know of people who started using IRC back channels in 1990s. I mean, when these technologies sort of became available, the activists in the region were like, yes, we can do something with this. And they started using it. I mean, the stories I have really do not start with Facebook. Or do you see, do they start with IRC, bulletin boards, early internet, mailing lists, you name it, they tried it. And then you have the blogs that started in 2005, 2006, and you had a lot of political bloggers. And I interviewed a bunch of them in Cairo, and it was really an unfortunate situation because a bunch of them did jail time. And one I interviewed, he had just come out of jail. I was like, what's Facebook, right? Because in the space of a couple of years, the social media ecology had completely changed, because when he was doing his political activism, he had a blog. And he could easily be singled out. His blog could be censored. And it was this, you know, very actively political space. Whereas Facebook is, you know, Facebook. It's where people give up their privacy. And I'm kidding. I won't start on a Facebook rant. Facebook is where it's a very effective tool for sharing the social grooming of day-to-day life. How are you? Here's my picture of my kid. This is what I'm doing. I'm here. What's going on? You know, the kind of day-to-day communicative rhythms that are integral to human life are very easily just, that's why Facebook takes off so quickly in country after country. There's a reason. I mean, Facebook isn't just coming and hypnotizing people. It fits into a very deep human social, human grooming, human impulse that you see in every society. This is something that I keep hearing. Well, it's not making us do something we wouldn't otherwise do. We've always been the kind of species that does this. We're just more visible right now. Now, so Ethan's cute cat theory is when you have a medium that connects people at this level, and they're doing non-politics most of the time, and all of a sudden politics can enter into it, then you have a very explosive situation because everybody's already there. Unlike a political blog you kind of have to go to, everybody's already on Facebook, so you don't have to go anywhere. And these regimes face the question of, shall we censor Facebook or not? And censoring Facebook is not that easy because, one, it looks bad. In Tunisia, Ben Ali tried it once, and it kind of backfired because he, as did Mubarak, partly survived by being the moderate guy of the West. You know, he partly survived by catering to sort of Western powers that he was a reasonable moderate guy, even though they were brutal autocracies. Censoring a fairly popular platform like that doesn't look good. So he left only Facebook in Tunisia, which completely backfired. We'll talk about it in just a second. Having everybody congregate in one social network is really bad if you're an unpopular autocrat. So Ethan's idea is that if everybody congregates around sort of a social grooming site like Facebook, then you have a bigger problem if you're an unpopular authoritarian regime. And in Egypt, people tend to have very large social networks. You know, they're large families. People have lots of cousins. I mean, most people I talk to, they like, I have 800 friends on Facebook. I'm like, do you really know them? And they'll be like, yeah, you know, here are my cousins, 8 of them, and then their children, 3 each. And then, you know, you just very quickly, exponentially get to these numbers. And the norm is to accept Facebook friendship. The norm is to accept people's, and this is just sort of the social norm around Facebook is kind of like the way I think more academics act around LinkedIn. I kind of accept I don't do much, but there's a norm to accept. You know, it's rude not to, which creates a very dense, connected, one large, you know, component right there. In Egypt, although I haven't seen any internal analyses of it, I'm pretty certain that's what it would look like, with lots of large networks, very densely connected, because people accept, you know, they Facebook friend their colleagues, and then their colleagues' relatives, and it takes very few, you know, degrees out to get the whole country in fairly dense network. So social media, picture video enabled mobile devices, and Al Jazeera. Now, the key to the Al Jazeera thing is that it also focuses regions' attention, right? Because we have a lot of attention fragmentation. So I want to emphasize there's a key role that's overlooked, is that you have this sort of social media kind of internet-y thing which is just having people's attention fragmented, and then you have Al Jazeera focusing it in a way that I think we're kind of lost it in the Western world. We don't really have, you know, sort of the whole I lost Walter Cronkite, I lost the war kind of situation, because there's no single place that our public attention can be focused the way Al Jazeera focuses the whole region. And when Tunisia uprising started happening, they wanted 24/7 coverage. And then when Egypt started happening, they wanted 24/7 Egypt. And those are really key to having everybody's attention, which also, of course, there's a whole back story about what this means for the fact that it's Qatari controlled. There's a current upheaval now that the person who headed it for 8 years has resigned. A royal member of the royal family is stepping in. So will that mean sort of Al Jazeera will become more overtly a tool of? Yes.
Well, I remember hearing that one reason that the uprising in Bahrain did not seem to succeed was that Al Jazeera was basically, you know, suppressing any coverage of it.
Well, I would slightly, yes, Al Jazeera is definitely not covering Bahrain the way it covered Tunisia, but Bahrain is, and we'll come to it in the end, it's a more complicated situation because there's a strong ethnic division. It's also a small country, and it's unfortunately on the wrong side of the interest calculus of both Saudi Arabia and United States. So we can discuss it briefly in the end, but the fact that Al Jazeera doesn't ignore it, but barely covers it and does not go into 24/7 mode matters. Now, so again, this ecology is the sort of, it's not just one or the other. Obviously, Al Jazeera can't be everywhere. It had no correspondence in Tunisia when Tunisian Revolution broke out, the uprising. It had nobody on the ground. But it had links that it had been cultivating for years. This is the difference between, as far as I can tell from Al Jazeera and CNN, is that Al Jazeera doesn't just seek out social media. They've been training and cultivating citizen journalists for maybe 5-10 years at least. I visited and interviewed people in their headquarters in Doha, and they have their social media desk, and they have it's integrated into the newsroom the way it's not. I mean, because what CNN does is here's what people tweeted. I mean, that's not what Al Jazeera does. It's got links on the ground, because a problem with sort of using social media in journalistic enterprises is how do you evaluate what's right and what's not? I mean, you're covering a country you might not have anybody in. How is this going to work? What Al Jazeera did, and what you see Andy Carvin doing now in sort of a different way, is sort of use established links and then branch out from there. You can't just sort of cover a place where you don't know anything about just through social media effectively. So in the case of Tunisia, for example, where they had no correspondence on the ground, there was an organization called Nawat, which is also works with the sort of Berkman originating Global Voices. By the way, I've told this to people before, Global Voices comes up again and again and again in this story. It's just sort of amazing, this kind of role that it played in creating these networks, which then ended up cooperating during these uprisings. Because how do you know which video from Sidi Bouzid is a video from Sidi Bouzid? Well, you need people that you trust who can evaluate this for you. And Nawat, which is a Tunisian sort of anti-censorship pro-freedom organization was a key link in saying this one, because they would scour Facebook where all sorts of citizen journalists, citizen activists, random people, whatever it might be, uploading videos, and Nawat would look at them, and knowing the country, knowing the region, they would be like, okay, this is what's looking like, this is sort of from today, and this looks like this, and this is not it. And then Al Jazeera would play it, and then people would look at it and say, oh wow, we're on Al Jazeera, and then they would document, this urge to document. Another thing that comes up in the region when I talk to people is people mention Iran, the Green Revolution, as a important moment. See, we look at it in the West and say, oh, it failed. Social media is not enough. Well, of course, social media is not enough. There's all sorts of dynamics. While it failed, it seems to have played a major demonstration role in the region to say you can control your message. Because of the way the message went out, they might have failed, but they had got their message out. And it seems that that created, that showed people, ordinary people too, something's happening, take out your camera. I mean, it's because this is not something you're just born knowing. The idea that you could control your message, I think, was in the region, first played out in the Green Revolution. So if you look at, I looked at an analysis of January 25 tweets, not all of them, about 250,000. There's millions, depending on your time frame. And Al Jazeera was the number one link from social media as well. So you see how it plays. Al Jazeera is, it doesn't have correspondence on the ground. It's showing people stuff that it gets from social media. It also gets linked heavily from social media. Now, cell phones also just don't document protests, but also crimes. And this is a, this creates a situation where people feel like they might be punished for what they do. There has been a lot of sort of anti-torture campaigns, and all these videos of torture, well, who's taking these pictures, right? The torturers themselves are also filming their own acts, which is, I don't really have an explanation. I've been discussing this with people. There are so many situations where people are documenting things that they could actually be held accountable for, and they know this, and they're doing it anyway. And if somebody wants to chat about, you know, this urge to document, this kind of, again and again and again and again, we see this. And these things often get out. So, and challenging of gatekeeping. Okay, now, so let me just unpack a little bit about social media. And you have all these different dimensions, and I played with how to create a nice visual. And I was joking last 2 weeks ago on the fellows meeting that there were all these people who were doing these art projects, and you know, sort of, we have a lot of Berkman fellows who are doing, and the close, I'm pros, I can't even, I couldn't diagram this, so I'm like, I'm just going to type this out. So you have, who's the sender, who's the receiver? So you could go from one to one, to one to some, to one to many, you know, sort of think of this as a matrix, right? And many to many is kind of like Facebook can be many to many a little, but often it's some to some because it's within groups. One to many is your classic television. There are people who use Twitter like one to many, who just broadcast their, you know, here's my press release or something like that, but a lot of people use it kind of some to many. So you have the sort of dimension of how many people are communicating. You have the modality. Is it asynchronous? Is it semi-synchronous? Twitter and texting are semi-synchronous, right? You don't really necessarily expect the immediate response, but it kind of works if people are immediately on it. It doesn't really, I mean, looking at Twitter chats is kind of like looking at human communication transcripts. They kind of don't make sense unless you were there at the time, so it's semi-synchronous. You have television, phone, IM, those are synchronous. Those all have different sort of implications. You have all this public-private continuum. Again, these are all continuums, so I didn't really even want to do a matrix. You need, I need what, five-dimensional. So what's a five-dimensional cube to put this all in? Then you have the network shape, the public-private, you know, Facebook is semi-public, private. You see this in the UK riots, right? The BlackBerry Messenger, the private many-to-many network coming to play a role. And I think that's partly because in the UK riots, you didn't have the sort of political organization and direct sort of political motivation, explicit and organized. So it kind of became a looting, rioting thing, and it went private, whereas in Egypt, it was this political move. And it went on public channels. So you can see the political nature of the unrest showing up on, whether it shows up on public or private channels. And then you have the network shape, whether it's directed where everybody has to acknowledge each other, non-directed where you have TV and Twitter are non-directed. You can be an audience without being followed back. And then you have the, whether it's visual, oral, textual. So you have all these multiple dimensions. And we used to only have a few filled out, right? We used to have the phone, the television, the letter, and you can see if you created my five-dimensional cube, you would only have certain points filled out. But when the ecology fills out, you really start getting effects, right? When you have something everywhere, where you have like, okay, can I have a public semi-synchronous text-based thing? Well, yes. And can I have a semi-public but visual but this? Yes. I mean, so what you're seeing is this whole, in terms of all the kinds of media ecology, a lot more of it is filling out. And critical mass is reaching. Enough people are on it. And where you have a situation where the dictator's dilemma is tipped in the sense that it would be very hard for a country to stay out of this development. You can be North Korea, you can be Burma, but it's not plausible for Egypt to completely unplug the internet forever. I mean, we saw they tried it even for a few days, and that didn't work either. That's not so when you're like that, and when the ecology is filling out, then you have these mechanisms. You have all the things I talked about, censoring, network shape, signaling preferences, documenting violators. The last one, coordination and information flow during protests, that's the one that gets the most attention. I mean, I remember the British Prime Minister during the UK riots wondering if people were coordinating their protests on BlackBerry Messenger. It might have happened to a degree or not, but you know what? I think they were mostly coordinating using television, because the television was constantly broadcasting saying, there's something going on and blah, blah, blah. So you don't really need, you know. Seriously, if there was one mechanism, I bet it was mostly television. But I think that's the least, it's important, but it gets the most play. I think it's not the most, like, it's important, but it's not the only mechanism that social media alters, whether people are like, okay, let's show up on, you know, corner of this and that and stay. So, censorship, to give you guys an example, this is an example I use a lot because I think it's a really nice comparative case, is in Gafsa, Tunisia in 2008, there was a protest broke out because of corrupt hiring practices in this mining town. It's a company town. There's a mining company operated by the government. And people were just upset. And there was a lot of protests led by the trade unions and sustained. But what happened was it was crushed and isolated. How did this happen? Well, the regime first sent in the police. That didn't work. And then they sent in the army. They arrested the leaders. And crucially, they kicked out, there was like one or two journalists, they kicked them out. And the movement wasn't very good in trying to sort of reach outside their borders in Gafsa. But also, there were only 28,000 people on Facebook in Tunisia at that point. There really wasn't this connectivity infrastructure where this could just spread. But the 2008 Gafsa looks really similar to 2010 Sidi Bouzid. It looks very similar in terms of sort of size, where it is, what's going on. But in Gafsa, the playbook, the authoritarian playbook, worked perfectly. They isolated the place, and then they waited it out. No news came out. And the trade unions, the leaders were in jail. The women continued the protest for a while. But how many months are you going to continue when everybody's kind of, the world's ignoring you? It died out. And so I think the Gafsa, I'm not saying it's the only difference. There's a, you know, the movement was much savvier, I think, by 2010. But in just 2 years, you have very similar events happening, and one takes off, and this one dies out. And the sort of the role of social media connectivity, in 2010, when Sidi Bouzid happens, you have about 2 million Facebook users in Tunisia. In 2008, you had about 28,000. It had just started. And in 2009, Facebook went Arabic, which was, after that, it really exploded. So you see this change. And again, it's the ecology, right? I mean, so it's not like it's just Facebook. Twitter, as far as I can tell, is used a lot more to bridge to the international audiences, which is also important because international audiences are part and parcel of how these regimes stay afloat. Or in some cases they might be disconnected, but usually for Tunisia, for Egypt, international audiences was very important, and Facebook was used more internally, and it was all connected with Al Jazeera. So the other, yes. Well, okay, I wouldn't give you like an exact number, but I would say probably like cell phone saturation seems to be a key indicator, because then nothing can happen anywhere without being documented. Look at Syria. I mean, after all that censorship, every day I get 20 videos in my inbox. So right, the cell phone penetration. I think for Twitter, I can't say a percentage, but you need a large enough number so that the connectivity to the outside world doesn't break off. You need at least a couple thousand very savvy people on it, and however many their networks are. And I don't really have a number for something like Facebook, but in Egypt and Tunisia, about 20-30% seem to have been enough to have been a factor. Now, that doesn't mean, again, it's not the only factor. It's lots of other things going on, but it means once you have 20% of the country on a social media platform, they also have families, and so from there on, it quickly fills. And no revolution is ever a majority event, right? You really don't have. You have at most sort of a plurality, so you don't need anything to be 100% for a social uprising to be consequential. If you look at history, you usually have 10-15% participation in the biggest revolutions we study as the big ones. 10% of the population mobilizes, and that's a big number. Yes.
We have a question here about radio. I haven't heard you mention radio.
Yes.
And how it played a large role in prior revolutions. Did it play one here?
Not much. I mean, actually, I'm not showing the numbers, but the amount of radio use was fairly small in Egypt from our survey. But you see it in other situations. And again, I'm not saying this was a good one, but say in the case of Rwanda, radio played a crucial role in coordinating the genocide perpetrators in that case. So it goes to show that it's not, social media can increase participation without necessarily being good. But from the protester survey, it's not a major player. It's just sort of there in the background, but not there. So the shape of the network. Okay, so if this is your network, right, and again, I'm sorry for my I've been like seeing all these great presentations by great people. I just do boring ones. It's passable. So if you have one shape like this, now see, this is all I could do. And you can break off the hub very easily. You break off the hub, and the what color would you call that? The blue ones are
teal
ones. Thank you. Teal ones are disconnected. But if your shape is network is shaped like this, where are you going to break? And this is really what happened. And when you saw Tunisia, when you saw Egypt, they tried to do this. It just didn't work. It just does. You can't break this off. And even when the cutting off of the internet, it was the activists were so ready. I mean, they had their satellite phones, and they had their dial-up numbers in Italy, in France, and Twitter has this open API, which makes it great for multiple ways of getting into it. The Noor network was still up, so people all went to the house of the one person who still had internet, and everybody just went there. I mean, because once you have something like this, the key pictures need to be only in one place, and they will spread. So the other thing is speed really matters. When the state is a resource-constrained actor, it really matters. I call this faster is different. If you talk to like the activists, they don't always have this conscious, because I mean they live through this, right? They're not sitting down and analyzing. They have countries to build and stuff. In fact, they're sick of us asking them questions about this. But Oscar Morales, who's an anti-FARC Colombian activist, I think he just verbalizes so well. He said, "If we gave them enough time, we will be suppressed and we will be crushed." In Egypt case, they set up something in less than days, and the regime was not fast enough to, crush them. And that's really important, because a state, again, think of it as a disease. If it's just spreading, where are you going to send your people to. If it's all, you know, sort of isolated in one place, then you don't really necessarily have to worry about it. And in the case of the Tahrir demonstrations, it had spread to many parts of the country. And in fact, the tipping point seemed to come when the labor unions also started going out in the street in that case. So the speed of social media is not just the incidental factor in these regimes. So finally, the social media knocks down the pluralistic ignorance, which we talked about. So united dissent can easily cascade, and it's really, I want to emphasize, it's not that everybody didn't know that Mubarak was unpopular, but it's more than that, right? Are you going to go? Are you going to protest? It's a very big, look, this is the biggest risk is to be part of a failed protest in an authoritarian regime. It's the biggest calculation you make is, if I'm part of this and if it fails. So people just don't need to know this authoritarian regime is unpopular. They need to know we're in it, and we're going to be here till we get rid of this guy. Otherwise, we're all in big trouble. So you need this kind of calculation cascades happening. And also, the Andy, I think Andy Carvin effect is real. Like, when he covers something, there's so many people following it, it becomes a news story. The counterexample is Syria, because the international community doesn't really have a lot of leverage on the place. So it's like, we know, but there's not much leverage. So the counterpart is that it you have to sort of, the counter-surveillance by people of the torturers, perpetrators. I just saw an interview with someone in Syria saying part of the thing that the dissidents in the army are doing are documenting who's doing what, so that after the regime falls, they hope they can use this to prosecute people. And people know this is happening. This really creates a different level of calculation. And I think this was an important impact in Egypt, too, because everything was being captured on camera. I mean, look at this sort of, are you guys following the Occupy Wall Street brouhaha, where, I mean, it was kind of the small protest, and it was sort of lingering, and I thought it would die out, but apparently the NYPD decided it should become a big story and decided to make that happen by these really pretty outrageous-looking tactics, where you have one video of one sort of bunch of women who are penned in these orange nets, and some guy just walks up and just maces them. It's captured on video. I mean, so there's this accountability strike. This probably happened a lot, but you can't really do it in this day and age and not have it captured, because I counted on that very scene. There's like, I mean, did I count 16 cameras on that little, 10 square yard area. So you can't really do this without, yes.
That particular event, I recall, I don't know if it got substantiated, but there was an accusation that Yahoo and Twitter were actively interfering with the communication network for that.
I really doubt it, yeah.
They were suppressing hashtags and, setting messages to spam folders.
What happened? Okay, so here, it won't go on, but Yahoo did block the, thank you, OccupyWallStreet.org. I just wrote about this in Slate. It's actually something that happens, because of, it's another problem. It's not active censorship. It's the dominance of these big algorithmic spam filters where there's nobody overseeing the network, and if something gets caught up.
Yahoo, in the case of Twitter, the big alleged they were actually suppressing certain hashtags.
I really, really doubt it in that case. But, I mean, if somebody shows me evidence, they do manual review at the last minute, but I don't think that they're fairly cautious of that particular thing. But that said, so and you also have encouraging of micropolicy. In the case of China, there's actually a lot of sort of change at the local level happening as the media ecology in China also fills out. And China is behind. I mean, yes, there's a lot of censorship surveillance, but like microblogging, it only has like 60, 70 million users now. The ecology is filling out slowly. So coordination info. Okay, so let's sort of talk some numbers for a while. Yes, Egypt, I'm not going to go on about, what happened, because it's sort of, I'm such a well-studied now, well, not well-studied, but such a current event. But it's multi-factor. There's youth elite dissatisfaction, there's the labor movement, rising food prices, demonstration effect of Tunisia, very important. People looked at Tunisia and thought we can do it. And now then Libya happened, and a lot of people are now saying, for example, for Syria and Yemen, Libya is important, because I'm seeing like lots of messages coming out of Syria now saying, why can't we get UN Security Council resolution? Why can't we get? So they're basing their calculations partly based on what they think happened in Libya. I think they have a much weaker chance, but we'll see. So this.
Zainab, wouldn't you also talk a little bit about the splits within elites, which is one of the classic, you know, factors
yes.
that social libertarians look at? So in that case, you have the whole army splits.
Correct. Well, or not to pretend to be an area expert in all the armies, but what I think has happened is that in both Egypt and Tunisia, you had a military armed forces that had the potential to separate itself from, it wasn't tied into Mubarak and Ben Ali the way the Syrian army is in fact fairly, not. It's not really even tied into Bashar, it's more independent and more powerful. Whereas in Libya, it was a harder case because it was less institutionalized. So if you have an institutionalized actor like the military, which can sort of say, okay, I'm not going down with that sinking boat, plays a major role. And like in Egypt now, the military has their main communiques through Facebook because that's they're also trying to play to that audience. Now, they think it's where, you know, it's cool also. Now, my sample is a protester survey. It's snowball sample. I'm not going to go into the details, but if you do any survey, you know it's not representative. But it's large. So it's 1,050 people. And this was done by the Engine Room, Tahrir Data Collective. This is an excellent sort of effort. I haven't really seen any similar surveys of protesters in any part of these movements. In fact, you rarely see these outside of Western countries because it's so hard to do. That's why it's snowball. So let's not overgeneralize it, but think of it as a sample of 1,000 people who were in Tahrir in February. So just very quickly, I mean, even the descriptives to me are fairly interesting. I'll show you guys some multivariate analysis, but it seems to have captured, see, there were a bunch of different groups in Tahrir. There was the ultras, the football fans, the sort of, that also became a political movement. There was Muslim Brotherhood, Ikhwan. There was a lot of sort of youth elites. And I think this is more the networked activist youth sample from the demographics. Now, when you look at how many of them have internet at home, you have 77% of the men and 90% of the women in this sample have internet at home. I think it's very telling that the women have more internet at home because it's two things. It's more a sign of privilege, right? So the females who were out in the street during these protests are slightly more privileged than the men. And also, I heard this again and again, in a country where you have this problem with women in the public spaces, online world is great. I mean, and you hear this from, like, the women I interviewed who are part of the Muslim Brotherhood. They're like, we can discuss stuff online, and we can, you know, talk about how women should be part of the sort of Muslim Brotherhood movement online better because they don't always have access to the meetings or they don't always get to get up and talk the way they can online. So the women are... about 70% male, 70-some percent male, and 20-some percent female. So it reflects what people have told me was kind of the rough division. So it seems to correspond to, again, I don't have like the, nobody surveyed the million people who were there, but what we have. So about a third of them had attended the protest before, so 70% are political novices in terms of street protests, which makes perfect sense. Okay, so did you use information communication technologies for protest purposes? Facebook and texting lead the way in terms of social media. And, of course, phone use is high up there. Satellite TV use high up there. And you'll see that blogs are kind of not there. And Twitter is about 10%. Again, I want to say Twitter fits into a different place in this ecology, so it still plays a major role, even though it's 10%. But this is sort of your general And women, again, are more on social media for political purposes than men, which fits for me into the sort of the qualitative interviews that I've been doing and listening to people talking about this, is that this opens up spaces to groups that would find it hard. Now, okay, I'm not going to go on and on about my logistic regressions, but I'll tell you what this says. I just wanted to put it up there, and since these are being archived, you guys can see this. What this table is looking at is a logistic regression of the likelihood that a person attended January 25. Remember, January 25 is the riskiest day, right? This is the day, and when I talk to people, here's how they describe whether they went there or not. So, you know, I'm telling you what one of the people who was there on January 25 said. He told me, so I emailed a couple of people outside of Egypt. I said to them, if I'm killed, please take care of my family. Here's some information. You know, make sure my sister is, you know, able to do this. And then I went because I thought we're either going to die or we're going to get rid of this guy. So this was the calculation. It was not a minor decision, right? So we're looking at whether or not people went there under those conditions, you know, sort of just basically saying ready to die. And you'll see that social media users, the stars mean significant. And what this is saying is, people who use social media for protest purposes were significantly more likely to show up for Tahrir protests on the very first day. And I think this is a significant finding, partly because of this cascade effect I told you guys about. If you can show up on the very first day in large numbers, that's your best bet. What you can't do, for example, the Occupy Wall Street people, right, in New York, they can build up slowly and they can sort of maybe work for months and years. You can have a protest in a Western country that gradually builds. And in fact, a lot of movements do build slowly. In an authoritarian setting, it's do or die, right? You're there. If you're there on the first day in large numbers, you may have a chance. If you're there as a small group, really not very good for both of you. But and social media users, this is controlling for age, education, gender, internet at home, etc. They're there on the first day. Now, again, I'm not going to sort of explain all of this, but what this table is looking at is looking at whether it was internet use in general or social media in particular. And what you find is that it appears like internet is associated with higher levels of protest participation, but when you break it down, it's not whether you use the internet in general, but whether you use social media that is more directly predictive of whether or not you show up on the first day. Yes? I'm explicitly not showing up the ones that are not significant. I'm just trying to highlight the ones that are significant because it would be even less readable than this. But I'm just trying to, like, put into words what those logistic regressions are doing. Is now, fascinating is that satellite TV is associated with lower odds of participation. Why? Because this is an activist group. So if you're an activist, satellite, if you're getting your info from satellite TV as opposed to Facebook, that's actually not as good as getting it through Facebook. If you're a regular person, non-activist, probably satellite TV watchers are more active. And this is what economists call inferior goods. If you get richer, there's certain goods whose consumption gets less as people move up the economic chain. And satellite TV might be that for activists.
Al Jazeera is included in that.
Correct, yes. So did you produce any visuals? And I find this fascinating. This is just a descriptive chart. 50% of my sample produced visuals from the ground and shared them mostly through Facebook and that phone and whatever else they could do. And, okay, this is like, if I could show one number from this, this is like my favorite one because it's descriptive, easy to understand. And if you say there's no representativeness to the sample, it was just total snowball, went skewed, everything, I'll take all of that and say this means there's 500 citizen journalists on the ground in this protest. Which, of course, it doesn't mean, it means there's probably tens of thousands. It is somewhat representative. But if you take away everything, and if these were the only people with cell phones in all of Tahrir, which they were not, it would mean 500 citizen journalists on the ground. And I'm just sort of thinking back, 10 years ago, this would have been revolutionary. Because if you have a, you know, protest somewhere, and you have, what do you have? Few people? A correspondent?
January 25th.
This is the month of February. This is because they. So Facebook is the primary mechanism. Now, again, I'm not dwelling on the numbers, but saying this is what the numbers look like. And what this table says is that those producers, those citizen activist journals, also were more likely to be there on the very first day. But they're not necessarily more likely to have been there in a previous protest. So it's not that they're these politically hardened, hardcore, they know what they're doing people. It's just there was these group of people. So what this is documenting is the existence of a group of people who were citizen activist journalism all into once, and they were more likely to be there on the first day. They probably more likely stayed and kept the protest going till the labor movement and other groups started stepping up, and I think for the army especially, along with the U.S. response, was a key. They kept the cascade alive till it just really burst, is what I'm seeing. And finally, where did you first hear of the protests? About half of them heard of it face-to-face, and about 28% first heard it on Facebook, which I think to me is amazing, again, because Facebook is such a new technology, and you have almost a third of the group saying they heard it first through this very new, very, you know, barely a year old in most cases, because 2009 was when it got introduced in Arabic. So, now I'm concluding. The first day is very important, and the first moments under authoritarianism are key to collective action. The visual production, documenting, very important. Obviously the Egyptian, the Tunisian, they're revolutionary processes. They're not completed yet. And it's really a big question where it will all go. But I don't think you can really tell the story of what happened without referencing sort of the connectivity infrastructure. Again, I want to emphasize this absolutely does not take away agency from the bravery of the people. I just told you what they risk. You know, they said, I am going to leave behind my life and my family, and I'm going to go and be ready to die, perhaps. So I'm not telling a story that takes away the agency of the people or undermines sort of the other parts, but I think the connectivity infrastructure was really key. And as a caution, I want to say that increased participation is not necessarily synonymous with increased democracy. If you have a polarized situation on the ground, say like on Bahrain, I've seen the social media situation maybe make things even more conflicted as the sides are openly denouncing each other in a way maybe that wouldn't have been possible before social media. It can increase segmentation. So what we have in the case of Egypt and Tunisia is united dissent overcoming pluralistic ignorance. It doesn't mean where you have a segmented, it's not going to automatically unite people. In fact, you can look at it to say social media amplifies dynamics on the ground. If the dynamics are on the ground are somewhat united dissent, it amplifies that. If the dynamics on the ground are polarization, it can amplify that. So I want to make that clear. And freer speech is not automatically linked with other values, right? Free speech and liberalism are not like, they don't follow from one another, or even free speech or tolerance. So this is kind of sometimes a mistake that more social media will automatically mean X or Y. I think it will mean more participation. But what more participation means is key. So the transition is very challenging. I'm going next week to the third Arab Bloggers Conference in Tunisia. I'm going to be talking with all these people that are now facing the challenges of transition. And it's just not the same thing. It's not like uniting against a dictatorship. And this is, I really found this really nice. Micah, who's the who is a co-founder of the Personal Democracy Forum, he made this comment during the Troy Davis protest on Twitter. It's like there's all this stop energy, and it really seems to be good for stop. But it's not really clear how this translates into the go, right? There's the no dynamic is fairly clear, no to Mubarak, no to, say, death penalty. But the go thing is much more complicated, and that is for questions, comments. This is, I mean, I can't really, yeah. Yes?
Thank you so much. That was quite interesting and insightful. I just want to know your findings, because there are situations where you will have these authoritarian regimes infiltrating the movement and then trying to create chaos within the movement. They do that in on ground, and they sometimes try to do that online by joining groups in very large numbers.
Absolutely, yeah. So two things. One, it seems like the Mubarak regime was not the savviest when it came to these... So we're probably not going to have the same situation. In fact, I like one of the activists, what he told me is that, you remember the Camels and Thugs Day, where they sent the camels? And he was saying, like, okay, here they are, and they're thinking, okay, they're going to shoot at us and kill us. But he thought, he started laughing because the man is sending camels, right? They are, you know, trying to, so they broke into the lamp poles to get electricity. They hooked up satellite phones, and they're hooking into Twitter using these proxies, and they got Tor downloaded on their browsers. The man is sending camels? I mean, he's like 19th century even is kind of too late for him, whereas the activists are completely in this different kind of mode, and he thought we were going to win. This guy is really not with it. So I think we saw this in Tunisia. We saw this. In the case of Syria, we're seeing already increased sophistication. In the case of Bahrain, we're seeing a lot of counter-mobilization. So it's not going to be the same thing again. But let me make two points to that, three things. One, there was a, let's just say, what's the correct word? Ridiculous, crazy proposal by the U.S. Defense Department decided to hire some company to create weaponized sock puppets. I'm not kidding. They want to create like million sock puppets to proliferate in these things. Well, okay, I mean, besides the wrong and dumb part, it's likely not to work as well, because a lot of the ways in which these networks work is that they don't, there's no online offline division, right? People are talking to people they otherwise know. So it's not, I mean, there's this conceptualization of the online world as a separate thing and things are happening there and has no reflection. No. In fact, a lot of the sort of activist, networked activism occurs with an embedded context, with an offline component that's just seamlessly integrated into it. So people, there will be, I think, if there's enough dissent on the ground, I think there will be, you know, the people will also have counter ways to do this. And another thing that comes up a lot is the surveillance issue, and I think that's U-shaped. If you're very few, and then you organize on Facebook, and then you go to a protest, you're likely to be picked up, right? If there are many of you, again, a state is a resource-constrained actor, they can't really arrest a million people, even if they have all their names. See, in Turkey, it used to be crazy. You used to need a paper from the police saying that you had no, I think, was it a felony or whatever? You had no record to enroll in the university. Now, back then, the police had everything in paper, right? So you'd go to the police station, and you'd say, I need this paper. And they would say, okay, and they'd just give it back to you. Because there was no way they were going to go back and search the files and find your file. They just stamped everybody and said, it was just one more chore you did, right? So surveillance isn't very useful if you don't really have the capacity to do something with it. And I think with the Facebook, that kind of surveillance is going to be useful to the regime if the dissent is relatively isolated or is a minority. I don't think their surveillance capacity is going to be that useful. You can have the names of a million people. What are you going to do with the names of a million people? And I think this is a question, the big question for China right now, which is putting all this energy into the surveillance. But I mean, the microblogging scene is growing so rapidly, as far as I can tell, even though it's in censored channels. At some point, they probably will either adapt the country in a direction that pleases more people, or they're going to face this problem. I mean, the numbers needed to do real-time censorship of a microblogging service, which in China now is 70 million. I mean, what, you're going to employ 1 million people to try to censor it? It's really not... It's very complicated how this works. But, I mean, your point is well taken that we're not going to face somebody as naive. I mean, every dictator on the planet or authoritarian regime, or everybody, I mean, even sort of our democracies, everybody's looking at it and saying, what do we do about this? Because here comes everybody, as Clay likes to say. Yes?
Your figures on print media were high.
Yes.
What's your analysis of the role of the print media and how that relates?
Well, two things. The social, the, they, a lot of people do read these print media, but the problem with that was it was during the uprising, it was so behind what was going on because of sort of the lag, and it was all just sort of, at first, they were publishing just, it's a nice day in Cairo. Do you have any news? No, I don't have any news. I mean, it's just sort of ridiculous, the level of censorship, and there's a huge backlash, and there was internal turmoil within the newspapers, and then it kind of broke through, too. So it wasn't a major player except to enrage people because everybody knew stuff was going on, but you'd look at television and it was showing. So it kind of was a confirmation of how ridiculous the censorship situation was. Yes?
I wonder whether you studied or compared social movement and fought themselves without social media to these. I mean, when the Berlin Wall fell,
yes,
the large movements in Leipzig and other cities, there were no social media.
Right.
So what's the difference?
There were social media, but they're offline.
Of this nature.
This is such a complicated thing, because it's that ecology I told you is filling out for maybe, you know, 50s. You have the telephone, and in East Germany, there's very high television penetration. It wasn't social in the sense, but there was a lot of feedback loops that people were seeing what was happening on television, and there was a lot of sort of networks of from everything from faxes to other things. But I mean, I think what it's more the way the sort of Eastern European regimes fell is more an example of the sort of the pluralistic ignorance falling in a cascade, because this is what usually happens to these regimes, is once the word gets out, it gets out very quickly, and there was just. So I wouldn't say there was no social media. Partly what Sasha is saying, but the ecology was much less filled. But another big difference, again, I can't get into, is I think the elites there were ready to throw in the towel so long ago. They were just like it seems like the East German elites were waiting to do exactly what happened. So it was kind of different.
A lot of what you've talked about has been events in the capital city and things like that.
Yes.
Has the social media helped or hindered involvement of people in smaller towns?
I would say absolutely. There's a lot of movements.
Absolutely, it helped?
It helped, okay, yes. Because, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sort of... Because what happens is, see, the thing is, if you're protesting, if you're putting your life on the line, the worst thing that can happen to you is to be buried in a pit of censorship. So, but if you're in Alexandria, which is not a small city, and you know you can get the word out that this is what you're doing, and you can get the video out, it's an enormous motivator to know that. I mean, there's a reason that the whole world is watching is such a popular slogan, which I have since learned came out of the 1968
convention.
Right? Because this is, and to sort of parenthesis, if you go back, you see relational, you see sort of television also playing a major role there. I mean, you see scholarship demonstrating that, partly because you could get the word out. It's, again, one-sided in the sense that you can't talk back to your television as effectively, but these communication channels are always important. I want to sort of say, like, this is especially key for nonviolent movements. George Orwell has a very nice, I don't remember the name of the essay now, he has a very nice way of formulating that one crucial requirement for a nonviolent movement to succeed is to know that people will know of you. And that's one key thing. And, you know, in India, being ruled by the British, who were cruel in all their ways that they were cruel in, but they had this tradition of a relatively free press, which, relatively speaking, I mean, you can find lots of examples of things they did do, but you could get the word out of what you were doing, because without being able to appeal to broader audiences, you can't really have a very successful nonviolent movement, in the sense that if you face a cruel enough adversary, they will just all shoot you. Are we last question, or
when
I'm
you
just
talk
looking,
about
we're
print,
fine?
When you talk about print media, it seems like there are really two different kinds of print media to take into account here. One is, you know, the mass media, you know, whatever the Egyptian equivalent is of the Boston Globe and the New York Times, but the other would be, you know, leaflets, wall posters, temporary newsletters, citizen-generated, ephemeral kind of print media. And certainly those media had a huge effect, you know, in this country in the 60s and 70s when there were mass protests going on here. How about where
well,
you're
I mean,
seeing?
Yes, yeah, see, I look at leaflets as, you know, remember the sort of, my five-dimensional cube? Well, leaflets are kind of there. Let's see. I mean, leaflets are kind of there because they are semi-synchronous and one to some, right? Because they disappear after a while, so leaflets are part of like that.
But they're very old media.
They are. I mean, you can go back to sort of, I have read as high as 500,000 for the number of people who read Tom Paine's pamphlets, right? Which is an incredible number because you assume people also discuss this with their... when I discuss social media, I'm not distinguishing between silicon versus paper versus this. The advantage of the network, the silicon version, is speed and sort of the affordances, but you can go back and look at faxes, you can look at, you know, pamphlets in the American Revolution as, you know, pretty much everything starting, all these communicative tools fit into these things, and yeah, they play
a role. When you say print, are you including that kind of print, or are you just talking about mass media print?
In this question, we asked for general printed material, so it would include leaflets. It would include leaflets.
I think we're actually out of time.
Two people had their hands up, so...
You want to take
their
questions?
Okay.
Sure. So the two dependent variables you have in the regressions, the previous involvement and activity early on, I wanted to know what the relationship... presumably those things are going to be correlated with each other, but maybe not. And I was just interested in if you tried putting those in the models as covariates in the model, so that we could talk about, for example, what the relationship is between media usage and involvement for the first time in protests. So controlling for previous engagement.
Let's stay in the next meeting, and we have state. I have the data. We'll do that. Literally, I've been just sort of. I wanted to say this. This is sort of really work in progress in the sense that we're just analyzing the data, but that's. Yeah, like on my page-long list of to-do things, but we will do that. We can do that today. Yeah.
We can continue it later. It was a question about. From the work that I'm doing in the immigrant rights movement, you know, I'm finding based on interviews with about 50 movement participants that media making is something that increases people's identification with the movement, which then. They become more involved later. And I thought it was really interesting that you had this slide on how people making the media about a particular protest hadn't necessarily, they weren't already the committed involved movement activists. So I'm just wondering whether there's anything in there or from your general work that would indicate that's been the case here too.
So two things. One is that the committed activists who've been to, they're a minority to begin with, so it's hard to have those correlations when activism was so suppressed to begin with.
No, I'm saying a non-committed actor goes to a protest, makes media about
right.
it, and
I don't
then
have
that's part of what gets them more involved.
We don't have a question about that, but it sounds absolutely plausible because if you don't, people have told me they were so happy when they take a picture of something and then Al Jazeera picks it up and you feel like I've done something.
Right.
You know, that's just completely plausible. It's just we don't have that question.
So I think we're about out of time. Thank you so much, Zane.